Today, our guest is Alan Trix, and we'll be talking about careers, leadership, and, of course, technology and innovation. Don't go away. Welcome to this episode of Cruzamento Podcast, the first of season 4. Firstly, big thanks for the fantastic feedback we've been receiving from our community. Keep it coming. It's very, very important for us to be able to improve and deliver with more quality. And also show some love by giving us 5 stars on Spotify, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. That really, really helps us to spread the knowledge far and wide. With all that said, now in today's show, we'll talk about the intersection of technology, healthcare. My name is André Correia, and together with me is my friend and co-host, Daniel Gadalha.
Hello, and welcome to another show of Cruzamento Podcast. Today, we have with us Alan Trix. Hello, Alan, and very welcome to this show.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, André. Delighted to be here.
Cheers. Excellent. Our very first question. In 30 seconds, who is Alan, and what is your leadership style like?
That's always an uncomfortable question. I think nobody really enjoys talking about themselves. I'll stick to some facts to begin with. I was born and raised in Ireland, but I've moved around the world. I now live in Portugal as of about 4 months ago. This is the 7th country I've lived in. So I mostly spent time in the US and Europe and a little bit of time in Africa. I'm currently the chief digital officer for Nokia. I've worked most of my career in the telecom industry since I got out of school as a 23-year-old. From a personal point of view, I have a wife and 3 kids, 3 teenagers. I like to watch football, used to play, now I watch. Manchester United is my team, and I like to run. I used to run competitively when I was younger, and I've been spending about 30 years trying to regain that fitness.
Awesome, Alan. And on top of everything that you just mentioned, you are also an enthusiast of AI.
Yeah. Not only AI, but I think a range of subjects. So I do consider myself a little bit to have a curiosity and to try to dig a little deeper. So yes, everything in and around science, technology, a little bit of healthcare, longevity. Yes, sociology, psychology, and very much AI. Of course, it's the hot topic of the day.
That's great. So let's delve into some of these topics, shall we? With AI. From your point of view, what would be the 2 key lessons that you believe are crucial for our audience to understand about the role of AI, not only in our lives, but also in the industries, because they will impact the business models and the industries?
Maybe it's worth putting it into context. We've had AI for a long time. I think the term was coined back in the 1950s, artificial intelligence. What's very popular lately since November 2022 is generative AI, when ChatGPT launched and really kind of shook up the world a little bit, including the world of technology and the world of AI experts. So it wasn't just that the mass market suddenly started to learn more about AI, but even experts in the field working in for many, many years were surprised by some of the innovation that's happened lately. I think one thing to recognize is that, why now? Because the technology, the algorithms, a lot of the ideas, a lot of the techniques have been around for a while. GPT is, the T is transformers, is invented by Google about 5-6 years ago. So this is not brand new. I think what's happened lately is that we've reached a point where computing power and the availability of data have come together to produce results on a grand scale. And if you look at the trajectory of all the different models and how they've been, the amount of data they've been trained on, the amount of parameters, that has just exploded on a log scale in the last few years. So it's really the revolution in computing, I think, and compute power and cloud power that has enabled this right now. I think another important thing to state is that where is this going and how big will it be? How much of an impact will it be? Satya Nadella from Microsoft has said that this will be bigger than the internet itself. And I tend to agree with that opinion. I think it's going to be quite dramatic. And even though we've seen dramatic things in the last 18 months, I think we're just at the beginning of this. And with that said, something I quote, not just related to AI, but frequently I've quote an old California scientist, futurist, Roy Amara, who's the one who said, we tend to overestimate the benefits or the effects of technology in the short run, and we underestimate in the long run. So the timing is something that's going to be very, very hard to predict and to get right.
Indeed, Alan. And you talk about big, you talk about impact. And we have been hearing on the news as well, tech companies having some layoffs recently, and some news, they point the finger towards AI. So considering the rapid advancements in AI, do you believe, we would love to hear your opinion, that it will ultimately create more jobs than it displaces? What factors contribute to your perspectives on this, Alan?
I'm an optimist on this. I think it will create. Maybe it becomes an easy scapegoat in media circles. It was funny a few months ago when, if you're familiar with the leadership changes at OpenAI and when Sam Altman got fired, there was one report that it was the first job loss as a result of AI. That was kind of funny, but I think it'll create in the long term. And we've seen many, many cycles of this in over history. You know, jobs that no longer exist that got replaced. A lot of machinery jobs, a lot of manual work on the farm, et cetera, got replaced by machinery. You know, horse and carriage buggies get replaced by cars and car drivers. And that will continue. And so we'll see the same thing. What I think will be different with AI is that it's going to go and go after and replace maybe a lot of the cognitive jobs. So some of the more traditional high-skilled white-collar types of jobs. Now, replace maybe is a strong word. Certainly augment. Doctors, teachers, software developers. I mean, there's that class of job is definitely exposed to the recent revolution happening in generative AI. It's interesting if you look at what the big companies are launching with their products. They're all using very friendly cooperation type of names: Microsoft Copilot, Google Duet, Amazon's code tool is Code Whisperer. It's all pointing to the fact that this is going to help you. And I think while it's good marketing, there's also a truth there in that. What I see in the early stages is that it's going to be a complementary assistant. I think I forget who it was who said now that, you know, we will all have our own co-pilot to go about our daily jobs. And I think that's true. We will definitely see a lot of assistance. And, you know, if you take a look at code development, you know, there's claims of 30 to 40% productivity gains. Some claim higher, that we will see massive productivity gains. And then the question is, will you see that percentage drop in jobs, or will you see that percentage increase in code output? Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be very much the latter. I think we're going to see a bit of a GDP boost. We're going to see more productivity. We're going to see products coming to market faster because of these tools, more than it will affect jobs.
And it's very interesting what's happening. And you've mentioned that the cognitive jobs will get augmented. Initially, the conversation was that it would be replacing jobs with basic skills, but it is now being proven that it's actually skilled jobs that are being augmented and not yet replaced. But that also leads us.
We went through the manufacturing shift, and I mean, people lost their jobs in manufacturing because of automation. I think we'll see a similar thing play out over the decades ahead with more cognitive jobs. And so there is no doubt there's also a social issue and a social problem that has to be tackled, because we have to deal with the retraining, obviously a taxi driver who may lose his job to autonomous driving vehicles is not going to immediately tomorrow step into some research job. So there's going to be a significant issue for us to deal with across countries in the world there.
And that also leads us to the question of education, right? Because 50 years ago, it was quite easy to decide whether to go for one job to another job, and the school curriculum would be the same and kind of standardized. We are moving towards more personalized teaching experiences, and AI will enable that. So from your point of view, Alan, could you elaborate a little bit on how AI can empower first-class teaching and contribute also to this individualized learning?
You said it with personalized. I think that's going to be the big impact and the change we see now, certainly with generative AI. But let's go back a few years and see, you know, there's been already a lot of change happening in the education industry with the with basic technology, connectivity devices. I lived in West Africa about 13, 14 years ago. And when I moved there, there was one single undersea fiber cable connecting the entire west coast of West Africa, of Africa. And today there's about 11, I think, just under a dozen different undersea fiber providers connecting the west coast of Africa. And so, you know, it's only in the last 10, 15 years that many places, you know, that represents a billion people on this planet, have had access to decent levels of connectivity and internet. And the costs have gone down as well, of course. And then so access to devices, power is also important. And there's also a bit of a revolution happening quietly, I think, in nuclear power that we'll see more and more of as we go forward, where we get an abundance of power. So all of this is the underlying technology that's been there and been changing for the last couple of decades to enable this. But you said it with personalization. I think with AI now, we have the ability for to have a personal tutor, to have a personal trainer. And when OpenAI launched their GPT-4, they did so with a few partners, including the Khan Academy. You're probably familiar with Khan Academy, some very good content for online learning. But they introduced a tutoring service, and I think it's a commercial service that they have now today. And it sort of guides and walks the student through the problem. So, for example, you know, you can go into a tool today and you can ask it to solve a math problem and you'll get an answer. But what they demonstrated is, I forget the math problem, but something like, you know, the student asks, what is the square root of 36 divided by the square root of 16 or something? And then it, or divided by, yeah, whatever, pick your numbers. And the tool will say, well, how could you simplify this? And the child might say, well, I don't care, just give me the answer. And the tool can say, well, think about it. Is there a number that they both divide by that could be simplified? Yeah. And the child is like, I don't care. I'm in a rush. You know, but you know, what about if you divide both numbers by four and you could simplify, right? And so the tool will adapt to the child. I already find this extremely useful as a parent, because when I'm helping my kids with math homework, with science homework, I'm often typing in the questions into the tools, and the last sentence is, please explain it to a toddler. the tool is far more capable. I can maybe get to the answer, but I don't know how to explain it to a child. That's where teachers come in and where they have a special skill. It's going to be very helpful to parents and to children and certainly the underserved who don't have access to first class teaching and tutoring.
Indeed, and those underserved, they are a big mass of population around the world, and one needs to look at them. And in your answer, Alan, you mentioned nuclear power, and I'm coming from the healthcare space as well. So immediately what came to my mind was legislation. And technology often outpaces legislation, and that can be a challenge. How effectively can we bridge the gap between evolving technologies and regulatory frameworks that govern them, especially in areas like healthcare, where the regulations are so heavy by nature?
Yeah, you're right that regulation is always going to be playing catch up with the technology, and it's a hot subject right now in the field of AI, and it always has been, I think, for nuclear. Sometimes it gets political, where heavy regulation is seen as kind of right wing and light regulation is is seen as more left wing and heavy and light is usually seen as a bit more sort of right wing or capitalist. But look, I think there's good and there's bad regulation. And this is where it's a challenge for politicians. It's a challenge for governments to strike the right balance. And sometimes they get it right and sometimes they get it wrong. If you look at the two big kind of technology shifts of the last 20 years with the likes of Uber or Airbnb, I think about those examples. I think the regulation handling with Airbnb has been pretty good in some cities. Some cities have clamped down on Airbnb rentals. New York City is kind of notable for this. Maybe gone a bit too far, perhaps. But there's a need to protect the real estate market. Lisbon is a very, very difficult real estate market. And I don't know if it's because of Airbnb, but in some cities, the rental market can be a factor. Now, at the same time, the ability for somebody to rent out a room of their house and make a little extra income is fantastic, or to rent out their entire home for 2 weeks or 3 weeks in the summer when they're away. that is fantastic. So, you know, smart regulation enables that. And I think also smart regulation maybe prevents just completely uncontrolled, where you've got major corporations building up massive real estate assets and dominating the rental market then. So, you know, I think I've seen Airbnb work very well with regulators to handle that. Uber, you know, one personal frustration I see is that I think we protect a little bit too much the old taxi industry. For sure, we have to protect the individual, because some of them have invested in taxi licenses. There's, you know, each country has some system of getting a license to drive a taxi. We have to protect them and compensate them in some way individually. But I don't like to see idle cars. You know, I landed at an airport the other day and it was snowing, and there's a line of taxis, and all of them are running with the engines on because they're cold. And to me, that just seems so out of date. You know, I think, you know, we need to be more supportive of the likes of Uber there, where it's more fuel efficient and it's better for the environment. So, you know, some cities manage it well, some don't. Regulation is important. There's a mix of good and bad. And yeah, sometimes it gets a bad rap in the media as well.
And across all these themes that we've been speaking about, Alan, one of the common points is data. And you've mentioned that earlier on in this conversation as well. So let's shift gears a little bit here and talk about data. And you've mentioned previously that data is the new sand slipping through our hands. I think this is really powerful statement.
Yeah.
Do we really need all this data? And can you elaborate a little bit more on this analogy, both challenges and opportunities?
You know, everything is the new.
Yes, indeed.
Back in the day, the oxen plow on the farm became the new people, and eventually the combustion engine and oil became the new plow. And what I find very amusing is I heard recently genetic engineering is becoming maybe the new oil. And if that's the case, then we're kind of back to people again. But the data metaphors are a bit overused. And I think it was the author Tim O'Reilly who I read this metaphor from, that data is the new sand, because it's hard to manage. It's hard to control. It slips through your fingers. It gets everywhere. It's in your shoes. It's in your socks. You know, it's hard. It's really hard. And it takes a lot of energy to produce, by the way. And in very small quantities, it's maybe worthless. In very large quantities, you might have a beautiful beach, or you can produce silicon chips. So, you know, the analogy is kind of just mostly amusing, I think. Do we need data? We definitely benefit lately from a lot of data in training models. And what's really interesting with the development of large language models is you see even low quality data has its value. So, you know, some of the models have been accused of skimming through New York Times, famously. They've sued OpenAI now over this. But I'm not suggesting that's low quality. I think that's high quality. But you have like Reddit threads and Twitter. Twitter has a lot of, you know, good and mixed level of quality text. Elon's new Grok LLM is trained on Twitter content. So, you know, lots of content volume there is very important and very useful for training these large language models. Then if you think more, you know, I think about my day job, which is working in the corporate, I think every corporation struggles with managing their data, knowing exactly where it is, having control, having the right access, trying to find the right balance between security and access rights is a tricky thing. And there's the concept of data minimalization. There is a certain sets of data you shouldn't have. Get rid of it. It just exposes you to risks of breaches. And so every company is looking at what data do they have and what do they hold and what should they be holding. And actively, you know, there is data that we should actively go and delete. As well.
It's super interesting, Alan. You mentioned Twitter. Now you were talking about exposing ourselves to certain risks, having certain data. And we had a very interesting conversation before about anonymity or the lack of it. So maybe looking at this, Alan, so with the diminishing idea of complete anonymity in the digital age, how do you perceive the current state of privacy, and what measures can individuals take to safeguard their personal information, if at all?
Maybe I'll go back to your comment or question around regulation, because that is one area where regulation currently does protect us. And in most of the Western world, I think there's a decent effort made around protecting privacy. And legislation is very, very important there for protecting privacy. Beyond legislation and government regulation, some companies take their own initiatives. Some do it for, I mean, they do it mostly because it's the smart thing to do from a business perspective. Google, Meta, Apple builds its brand around trust. Apple is probably the most protective of your privacy and your data. And they've made changes in their way of handling customers and handling customer data, all aimed at protecting their customers' privacy and their customers' data. So that's good. That's smart business by them. We build an image of Apple as the company you can trust. You can trust to open up and expose yourself to. But it's also maybe a generational thing. If you've got kids, you know that especially teens or young adults, you know that there's kind of a less consideration for privacy than us of an older generation. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this goes. It's quite a scary world out there if you don't have the protection of government, or you don't have the big brands like an Apple trying to actually sell the idea of privacy protection. I played around with the tool PIMEyes recently. I mean, that is kind of scary. Small partial images of your face can be scanned, and if there's any presence of you anywhere on the internet, it seems like it can find it. So the idea that anybody could now grab a picture of a child, of a stranger, I mean, you can think about cases leading to stalking and other dangers. So I think it's a very, very serious issue. And it's one that the industry will continue to grapple with. It's not going to be resolved.
And then just taking that as a segue, Alan, as well. So personally, I love technology. I love innovation, but I especially like and really enjoy how it impacts the human lives, hopefully for the positive. Mm-hmm. In the realm of healthcare and technology, how can advancements in data analytics and AI, which are the topics we've been discussing, contribute to our understanding of longevity, wellness, and what challenges might arise from that?
Daniel, I think you're definitely more the expert on this healthcare space than me. So I can only talk about what I read, and I don't, because I don't work in the healthcare space. But what's really amazing to see is the work that, for example, Google's DeepMind is doing with their AlphaFold predicting protein patterns, protein structures. You know, proteins built of, I guess, a string of amino acids and formulated into 3D shapes, of which there can be, I've read one quote, there could be 10 to the power of 300, maybe variations or options there. Some staggering numbers. But they put, I think they put about 100,000 recognized protein structures in their tool. And over a long period of time, training the model, training the data, they can now predict with really, really good accuracy the structure of upwards of what now we know, about 200 million proteins from what was some very, very small numbers previously. So that's fantastic and amazing for drug discovery, for battling diseases. But then I think maybe the challenge is taking it from the prediction to actual drug discovery and drug creation, because I've also seen and read where there's a chasm there to cross, and it's not easy to translate from the computing computational predictions into the life sciences work in the lab to actually create the drug. So it's promising, but making that jump over into actually creating the drug is a challenge. I saw MIT just before Christmas announced a new antibiotic to fight a bacteria that previously was resistant to any drugs known. I think it was the MSRA bacteria. And this leads to a lot of illnesses and some deaths around the world. But being able to process very, very high volumes of data with the computational power I mentioned at the beginning of the call here is what leads us to accelerate the drug discovery. So it's not, AI is not going to create new drugs. AI is not going to solve diseases, but it will accelerate the speed. But as I said, there's a jump to get to, and I think Daniel, you can lecture me on this. There's a jump to get to. I think the actual drug creation and the disease solutions.
Beautiful, Alan. And for someone curious, you do have lots of knowledge, and at the beginning as well, you mentioned your interest, and they span across different areas. Mm. Maybe let's pick here a bit on longevity. So, can you connect the dots between these areas and elucidate the role of technology can play in this space of promoting longevity?
Yeah, I'm a novice student, I would say, of the topic of longevity. Or I'm interested in health span, having a healthy life, being a very mobile, fit, active 70 or 80 year old. I'm not one who cares to live to be 120 or something. I definitely do not want to outlive my children. But having a healthier, older life is I think important. And there's an increasing there's a lot of developments happening in this field. And I can say personally, I take a few supplements. I practice intermittent fasting when I can, but not religiously. I do not sacrifice going out at night for a beer. Sleep is very important. I definitely don't practice what I preach there. But you know, and it's interesting, a question about technology, because there's an anti-technology issue there. One of the most important things you can do, I think, for longevity is to shun some of the technology. Your screens. Don't use your screens at night. Stay away from them. Blue light on your phone, you know, not a good idea. There's a lot of interesting technology now with around sleep, such as, well, we've had the devices for a while. I've worn an Oura ring. I've worn a Fitbit 10 years ago. These devices continue to exist. I actually got rid of the Oura ring I was wearing because it taught me a lot about my sleep patterns, my heart rate variation. But then I was just getting a little bit stressed about it. I had to charge it every 2 or 3 days. I was forgetting to charge it, and then I was going to bed and it was dead. Or I forgot to put it on. I had it off and I forgot to put it on. So I'm in bed and then I get out of bed. And I just thought, you know what, I'm not learning as much anymore about my patterns. So I actually got rid of that technology.
Interesting.
There's a lot of interesting technology happening in the bed and the mattress space. 8Sleep is a company that's really interesting. I think Sleep Number is another one. There's a few startups out there and some that have been in the business a while. But the bed has a lot of sensors. The bed has a lot of temperature adjustments. You know, temperature is very important. We have a different temperature throughout the night. We may have a different temperature than the partner we sleep with. Some of these bed technologies now are offering adjustments in temperature and separate temperature for different sides of the bed and many measurements. I heard the CEO of 8Sleep on a talk of a few months ago, and he was kind of making an interesting comment that, you know, we have you in our real estate for hopefully, you know, 7-8 hours. And there's a lot of things we can kind of study and see and learn over those 7 or 8 hours. So that's really interesting technology, I think. But the big breakthroughs, I think, are going to be more in the medical side, the supplement side, more on the health sciences and the healthcare side.
A lot of great hints and tips for our audience, Alan. Thanks for that.
If you want to learn more, study this guy, Brian Johnson. Do you know him?
Brian Johnson.
No.
He's a tech founder. I think his business was payments or financial transaction payments. I think he sold his company to PayPal. So he made money and he's comfortable and he doesn't have to work again. He's devoted his entire life to being a lab rat for longevity. I wouldn't do most of what he does, but I admire that he's sacrificing himself to this. He takes over 100 supplements a day. He's got a very rigorous and strict sleeping and eating and exercising regime. He does all kinds of, keep track of the amount of things that he measures in his body. He does laser therapy on his skin. He does micro needling. He uses a variety of creams. He discloses all of this in his, he's trying to make a business now out of it, I think. So, but Brian Johnson, you can look him up, type, maybe Google search Brian Johnson longevity or something. But he's trying everything. So you can, if you want the full set of ideas, he's got them.
No, we'll do that, and we'll add them in the show notes as well for those listening to us.
Okay,
Alan, we are coming to an end. Our podcast has a very strong and dynamic community, and we've asked them to give us some ideas for questions, right? So here's one from them. And again, thank you very much for everyone out there, which is part of this community. You have moved to Portugal. Nokia has also been investing in our country. This is publicly known. How's the experience been so far, both on the personal and from an investment point of view?
I joined the running club here recently, the Lisbon Digital Nomads Running Club, which is good. I've only gone out a few times, but I need to do more because I've fallen victim to pastel de nata. I cannot resist. I like it here. It's a very international community, which is an important thing for development economically and especially kind of tech development, because you can't do it in isolation. You need the diversity that you get in places like Silicon Valley. People underestimate the diversity that exists in the story of Silicon Valley. It looks like it's one little place in America. But when you think about it and you look at the heritage of it, the Google boys, you know, coming from growing up in or a heritage in Russia, even Steve Jobs, his dad was from Syria, right? You have, you know, Satya Nadella from India, Sundar Pichai from also from India, running Microsoft and Google, respectively. A lot of the innovation comes from the diversity, and I think Lisbon is an attractive city for foreigners to come to. I know I've been part of discussing a number of people coming here, and it's not a hard sell; it's an easy sell. Not just the pastel de nata, but the weather as well. Flight connections are good. There's a number of factors like that. And I think for work, for the type of work we do, look, I think every city is on a scale where you can compare costs and talent. You can go to some very cheap places and you'll struggle to get the right talent, the right skills. You can go to some very expensive places and you'll get an abundance of talent. And you're always looking for some mix. I think, and if there's a line there drawing the relationship, you kind of want to be above the line, right? You want to be favorable on one or both of those things. I think Lisbon is, I think, moving up that curve a bit. It's not cheap. It maybe was 20 years ago to come to Portugal and do business in Portugal and think of Portugal as a near shore or an offshore site. It's not that attractive anymore from that perspective, compared with some parts of Eastern Europe or India, let's say. But it is moving up on the talent scale. And we announced about a year ago, for example, in Nokia, that we're hiring about 100 5G and 6G radio engineers. So research staff. In my area, digital office team, we're hiring solution architects, Oracle, SAP experts, data engineers, AI engineers, those types of skills, higher value skills. So I think Portugal has evolved already now and will continue that journey to be a place where you might come for the skills more than the costs. Maybe 20 years ago, you came more for the costs. So that balance, I think you have to keep an eye on it and you have to continue investing. If you're going to be getting more expensive, you have to be getting more talented. And you know, I mentioned the international community, that the ease of coming here, the diversity that's here, that's important. That's an important part of it, because drawing talent from outside is an important part of the equation as well. So yeah, very happy. I think it's been good to move here, but it's early still for me.
Thanks, Alan. And I do see here that pastel nata might be a good supplement for longevity as well. So it's a joke for our audience. Okay, it's lots of calories. So Alan, we would like to thank you very much for your time and availability today. We talked with Alan about so many different beautiful topics. So leadership, artificial intelligence, data, and how to connect the dots around health and well-being. Alan, maybe the very last question, in case our audience wants to know more about you, where they can find you online?
I guess LinkedIn is the main thing. I'm not too active on too many social medias. I am on Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter, but I don't really post. I just learn. So I, you can find me there or connect with me on LinkedIn.
Alan, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. And thanks for everyone that has been listening to us and watching us on YouTube as well. So don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe to our podcast for the latest episodes. And also connect with us on LinkedIn, Instagram, and your favorite podcast applications. Also, check out for the show notes. We'll definitely put the Brian Johnson hint there and a lot more that we've been talking about today. Thank you very much and see you soon on Cruzamento Podcast.
Thanks, everyone.